Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the growing peace movement and the power it may have to stop or slow President Bush's plan to launch a war against Iraq. Bruce Shapiro, co-author of the book Legal Lynching, who examines Illinois Governor George Ryan's mass commutation of death row inmates and its impact on the movement to abolish capital punishment. And Reverend Joseph Lowry, co-founder and president emeritus of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's decision to oppose University of Michigan's affirmative action policy in a case soon to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A global plunge in coffee prices last year resulted in unemployment of 250,000 coffee pickers in Nicaragua who were also forced to live in roadside camps without adequate food or sanitation. And nearly half of the children in the camps suffered from chronic malnutrition. The government was forced to enact some short-term measures like food and job aid and debt relief for coffee owners. The crisis, in part, was provoked when the U.S. pulled out of the International Coffee Organization in 1993 that had employed a quota system to control prices for three decades. As Oxfam's Phil Bloomer argues, the coffee giants have presided over a vast expanse of human misery at the bottom of the supply chain, but have done nothing to prevent it or stop it. Now, Oxfam and fair trade advocates are pushing the coffee roasters to pay a fair price to farmers in the developing world. As Fatima Ismael Espinosa of a leading Nicaraguan coffee co-op explained, buying coffee at prices that are much too low and then giving a loaf of bread with the other hand is not the kind of solidarity we want. To the surprise of many visitors, a huge limestone mine is located in the center of the Florida Everglades and is the focus of an $8 billion ecological restoration effort. The mine, known locally as Lake Belt, supplies concrete for construction of roads and sidewalks in South Florida. The Sierra Club and other environmentalists oppose plans for new mines in the same area due to the potential loss of 15,000 acres of wetlands over the next several decades. Activists say the deep pits will drain water from the Everglades and expose underground drinking water supplies to contaminants like Giardia and Cytosporidium. In response, the Sierra Club and other environmental groups are suing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for approving the mine permits without accounting for the damage to water quality and wildlife, including the endangered wood stork. At first glance, Phil Harvey appears to be a mild-mannered businessman. His North Carolina warehouse may look unassuming, but his company, Adam & Eve, is a leading marketer of adult entertainment paraphernalia. Last year, Adam & Eve churned out a booming $80 million business in adult toys. The company was started by Harvey 30 years ago as a mail-order house for condoms. Interestingly, Harvey puts much of the X-rated profits into a nonprofit enterprise, DKT International, that sold over 350 million condoms a year and millions of birth control pills to eight nations. The outfit also markets female condoms, IUDs, and injectable contraceptives, all at below retail cost. According to Mother Jones magazine, DKT's condoms now dominate the market in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. Still, Harvey is viewed as an outcast by the family planning establishment, which mostly uses doctors and nurses and not slick marketing to promote birth control. As Bill Shellstead of Family Health International notes, it is hard to deny that commercial distribution has infinitely greater reach in the population than voluntary organizations or even governments. Harvey's interest in birth control began in the mid-1960s as an aid worker for CARE in India. Harvey concluded that India's poor needed family planning and not more food. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved just like a tree that's standing by the water.
While war planners at the Pentagon drop their strategies for an invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration continues to deploy U.S. troops to the Persian Gulf region, 125,000 since Christmas. But political advisors at the White House must be a bit concerned about recent events, which point toward diminishing support for a war at home and abroad. In the UN Security Council, France publicly declared it would refuse to support any U.S. resolution authorizing military action against Baghdad in the coming weeks. Security Council members China and Germany also rebuffed the Bush administration's view that an interim report from UN weapons inspectors on January 27th was not the end, but the beginning of a longer process of disarmament in Iraq. There is wide speculation that President Bush may use his January 28th State of the Union address, the day after the UN report is issued, to announce his plans for war. On the weekend commemorating the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., hundreds of thousands of citizens across the U.S. gathered to protest the Bush war drive. The largest of these rallies was held in the nation's capital January 18th, with estimates ranging from 200,000 to 500,000 participants. Other demonstrations were held in San Francisco, Tokyo, Paris, Hong Kong, Portland, Denver, Chicago, Boston, Tampa, and dozens of other communities. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who attended the Washington rally, about the growing power of the peace movement and the mood among members of the UN Security Council.
I think that there's no doubt that the Bush administration has to be very nervous about the scale of this demonstration, not only because of the tens of thousands of people here. We can't even tell. This demonstration is so big. We can't see the ends of it. We don't know. Is it 100,000? Is it 70,000? Is it 150,000? But it's tens of thousands of people. But it's not only that. It's taking place in the context of a growing anti-war movement that is reaching broader and further than ever before in this country at a moment when we've had to move so fast. We're way ahead of where we were at the comparable period in the Vietnam War or in other wars as well. And the breadth of it, the fact that you have a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal of Republicans against the war saying, we want our money back, we want our country back, that we feel betrayed. That's an amazing statement. You have public statements from military leaders saying this is not going to be an easy war, this is not going to be a quick victory, this is going to be a long and bloody fight. That's a strong statement against this war, and the Bush administration has to be hearing that. So I think that fact and the fact that internationally they stand alone, despite the claims that this is going to be a war of either the United Nations or a so-called coalition of the willing, this is really about a coalition of the coerced. That's what we're talking about here, and I think that they're very worried about that.
Is it possible that with growing opposition here in the United States and abroad, that the Bush administration may feel pressure to actually execute the war plans earlier than they might otherwise have?
It's certainly a possibility. There's always the danger of that. The fact that they now have 150,000 troops already stationed in the region around Iraq means that it's very difficult for them to withdraw. It's very difficult for them to pull back. There has to be a way they can pull back if they want to declare victory, and get out. That's the key. That's the way to protect this country, not through going to war against Iraq. And I think that things like this demonstration, the demonstrations that are to come on February 15th, the fact that these demonstrations are taking place around the world, makes that not only possible but necessary for the Bush administration. They are going to pay a very high price here at home in the polls. They already are paying a price for the economy tanking. And when they face this kind of a challenge, they're going to have to pull back and say, the American people don't want this.
I wonder if you could just address the issue of how the media covers this opposition movement, the movement opposed to a war, because early on it seemed that they were blatantly, purposefully ignoring a lot of the organizing that were bringing out thousands of people to the streets, and how that intersects with public opinion. How do people out there in the hinterland know there is an opposition movement and know the reasons why people oppose this possible war in Iraq?
I think that there has been a major shift in the media coverage. As you say, in the early days of this movement, it was very difficult to get media coverage. Some of the media outlets, like the Washington Post, was clearly cheerleading for war. Others, like the New York Times, was not. So there were differences. The Times and NPR famously undercounted the big demonstration in October. Both of them were forced by public pressure to pull back and issue new stories with the truth. Since that time, we've seen far more interest in the movement. I've done probably a dozen interviews in the last 24 hours with stations all over the world and print outlets as well, who are looking at the question of what is this new anti-war movement? How broad is it? Is the African-American community involved? Does this involve immigrants? Are immigrants afraid? Are they coming out? Is the women's movement there? Where is the environmental activist? And there's a sense that this movement is far broader than anything anybody imagined before, and they have to take it seriously now.
One last question. You've written about the United Nations and its inner workings for many years. Tell us what's likely to happen in your mind. Will there be a second vote in the United Nations Security Council for a declaration of war against Iraq? Or how might this work? And what do you think the attitudes of the nations within the Security Council are to George Bush's plans?
This is a very dangerous moment. We don't know what's going to happen in the United Nations. There's not a country other than the United States and Great Britain that think it's possible to legally go to war in the name of the United Nations without a second vote. That doesn't mean there will be one. The U.S. has shown over and over again its ability and willingness to use bribes and threats and punishments of other countries to ensure that they vote the way the U.S. wants. We don't know if that's what they're going to do. They're already talking now about a so-called coalition of the willing as opposed to a U.N. resolution. That, in my mind, would be an admission, an acknowledgement by the Bush administration that this war stands in violation of international law, is not justified by U.N. resolutions. And the U.N. Charter, which is the supreme law in the world and in the United States since it was ratified in 1945, the U.N. Charter is very clear that the only legitimate wars either require a decision by the Security Council, which we will not have, or a case of immediate self-defense, which we do not have. So this war will be a clear violation of the UN Charter, a clear violation of international law, and that itself gives us an important tool to oppose it.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. In his last act as governor of Illinois, George Ryan commuted the death sentences of all 167 individuals on death row. These inmates, sentenced by juries to die, will now serve life sentences without the possibility of parole. Ryan, a conservative Republican, had come into office supporting capital punishment, but after 13 death row inmates were found to have been wrongly convicted, the governor became convinced that the system was deeply flawed and declared a moratorium on executions in 2000. He also formed a commission to investigate the problems in Illinois' death penalty system and make recommendations for reform. In announcing his historic decision on January 11th, Governor Ryan said, quote, "Because our three-year study has found only more questions about the fairness of sentencing, because of the spectacular failure to reform the system, because we have seen justice delayed for countless death row inmates with potentially meritorious claims, because the Illinois system is arbitrary and capricious and therefore immoral, I no longer shall tinker with the machinery of death." Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Shapiro, who co-authored the book Legal Lynching, The Death Penalty and America's Future, along with Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. and his son, Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. Shapiro assesses Governor Ryan's mass commutation of death row inmates and its impact on the movement to abolish capital punishment.
This is a historic moment. We are really in the middle of a big sea change in the politics of capital punishment in this country, of which the clearest expression was Governor Ryan's commutation of 167 death sentences in Illinois the other day. And this resonates far beyond Illinois, I think, because Governor Ryan really represents where a lot of Americans are. If you look at all the polling data about the United States, this country, formerly fanatically pro-death penalty, has really moved to the point where now a majority of Americans would prefer life without parole, and to the point where a majority of Americans are deeply troubled by all these real stories of false executions. Like Governor Ryan, with his close-up and personal encounters with the minute particulars of death penalty, the more Americans know, the more uneasy they become. So Governor Ryan's action, while unprecedented in its sweep, is not out of the blue. It really speaks to a deep disquiet in the American public, even in states like Texas, even in, say, Virginia, where the new incoming governor in one of the most active executing states in the country, where the new incoming governor just gave the legislature a big lecture about how they're not doing enough to look at innocence cases, to the point where conservatives, pro-death penalty conservatives like Sandra Day O'Connor, Supreme Court Justice, are deeply alarmed and have expressed it about the credibility of the whole criminal justice system being at risk here.
Bruce Shapiro, what's the potential for backlash here? Is there likely to be a backlash against governors who've taken a stand to invoke moratoriums? Because during coverage of Governor Ryan's commutation in Illinois, there was a lot of attention paid to family members of victims and the horror they felt at the overturning of the death penalty in their loved ones' cases. You also had many prosecutors getting on the air saying that this abrogated all the work and time that people spent on these cases, these very expensive and long and drawn out death penalty cases. Do you think we're going to see some anger and some fuel thrown on the fire of those who want the death penalty to remain intact?
Only time will tell. I think that the prediction of a backlash is greatly exaggerated. I think, to the contrary, that several factors will give this issue some legs. For one thing, while it is true that in Illinois there were many, many deeply anguished and aggrieved families of victims who came out in favor of keeping the death penalty, you also had in Illinois and have around the country something that you didn't have in the 1970s when the idea of victim rights was joined up with the idea of vengeance and the idea of the death penalty. You have a well-organized, articulate, and vocal victim families who are opposed to capital punishment. There's a whole organization based in Cambridge called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, which played an active role in Illinois, which is active around the country, and is a wonderful organization that has the moral clout to influence this debate and to counter the idea that victim status automatically means that you seek ultimate vengeance. That factor wasn't on the scene before, and I think the prosecutors who were hoping for a backlash and the politicians who were hoping for a backlash don't see that coming. I also think that those people who are predicting some huge backlash to Governor Ryan don't understand just how deeply most Americans are troubled by the idea of executing an innocent person. And once that doubt is opened up, you can't put it back in the can. It's there. There will certainly will be people who will try to generate a backlash, who will try, both in Illinois and nationally, to use this to accelerate the pace of execution. But I have a hard time believing that it's going to have political legs.
Shapiro, just a final question. What's the international impact of Governor Ryan's action in commutation? And what, in general, do you think the view is from outside the United States, particularly in Europe, where the death penalty has been abolished for quite some time, about how the United States is handling this issue of capital punishment?
It's really crucial, and actually played a particularly important role in Illinois. You know, I would be disingenuous if I didn't say that Governor Ryan has been, over the course of the last couple of years, a man in a lot of political trouble at home. He's got a scandal-plagued administration, some of his top aides indicted in a license-peddling scandal. And in many ways, the attention from abroad, the calls from people like Nelson Mandela, really helped give the guy a sense of moral ballast and a sense of the consequences of his actions. And I believe, having talked to him, that it's not just that he was trying to write his name into history. I believe he was genuinely moved on the issue. But there's no doubt that for an American politician, a parochial local politician, whether it's Governor Ryan or Governor Ehrlich or any of the other governors around the country who administer capital punishment, to see their actions on the death penalty in an international context, to understand that the closest allies of the United States around the world, and indeed a majority of the world's countries, have now abolished capital punishment. All of this says that, as with the abolition of slavery, the rest of the world has sort of passed the United States by, and we are sitting here now having had a practice which was commonplace worldwide, capital punishment. Things have now completely changed, and now only Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, China, those are our peers in the practice of capital punishment. The rest of the world has abolished capital punishment and takes it very seriously and views it as a huge abuse of state authority, and there will be political and economic consequences if you continue down this path.
That was Bruce Shapiro, co-author of the book Legal Lynching, The Death Penalty and America's Future, along with Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. and Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., published by Anchor Books. Following close on the heels of the controversy sparked by Senator Trent Lott's racially insensitive comments, the Bush administration has chosen sides in a landmark affirmative action case that will soon be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. The president will file a brief on behalf of prospective white students who allege in a suit that the University of Michigan's race-conscious admission policy unfairly discriminated against them. White House spokespersons say that the administration's goal is not to overturn all college affirmative action programs, but just that used by the University of Michigan. But critics contend that Mr. Bush's stance on this case has cast a shadow over his presidency. Civil rights activist Jesse Jackson attacked Mr. Bush as, quote, the most anti-civil rights president in 50 years. The Michigan case reopens the debate ignited in the 1978 Supreme Court Bakke decision, which narrowly ruled that quotas were impermissible, but that the use of race in the pursuit of diversity could be allowed. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Reverend Joseph Lowry, co-founder and president emeritus of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's decision to oppose the University of Michigan affirmative action policy.
The Trent Lott debacle was interesting in that the truth of the matter is they got rid of Trent as the majority leader. But the Trent Lott mentality, in spite of the fact that he proclaimed over and over again on national television that he supported affirmative action, the truth of the matter is that the Southern strategy, which he symbolized and which this administration had exposed through Trent Lott, and that's why they got mad at him, he exposed their Southern strategy, which opposes affirmative action. And so we talk about race-based initiatives. We talk about race-neutral policies for admission by universities and hiring by corporations. The truth of the matter is we know full well that the inequities that we see in this country based on race did not occur by osmosis. They did not occur accidentally. They occurred as a result of deliberate, intentional policy, and they will not be addressed or remedied except by intentional, deliberative policy, and that's what affirmative action is all about.
What do you think went into the decision that the Bush administration made to attack affirmative action at the University of Michigan with this upcoming Supreme Court case? What kind of political calculations do you think they made?
I think it's another round on the ladder that leads to Southern strategy. They're appeasing the right-wing element in the party. And it's interesting to me that the president, who I understand got into to the university where he attended because points were given him because he was the son of a graduate. So that people who are children of alumni get points. But yet we're objecting to the children of those who are excluded because of their race getting points because the university wants to address that inequity.
Reverend Lowry, what in your mind are the consequences if the Supreme Court overturns the University of Michigan's admissions policy? What will that do to affirmative action nationally?
Well, I think it'll have a devastating effect. I think it will result, as it has in other places, a serious decrease in the enrollment of minorities. The fact that minorities have challenges is because of they are deprived background in early education experiences, in the disadvantages of their families. And it's not just blacks and browns. I think there are disadvantaged whites who need attention as well. But the effort on the part of the University of Michigan is, I think, a courageous effort to avoid the pitfalls of other universities that have been forced to take out their affirmative action plans. And the result is you're going to get an all-white campus.
Reverend Lowry, you hear the rhetoric of politicians and right-wing talk show hosts who allege that affirmative action, as it's played out in places like the University of Michigan and others, really effectively discriminates against white students with high grade point averages. And how do you respond to that idea that somehow affirmative action is discriminatory and defies the whole issue of preventing discrimination on the basis of skin color?
I think there are very rare cases where some whites may not have gained admission because of the number of minorities admitted. That may be, but when you hold them up against the millions, the generations of minorities who've been excluded very deliberately, and when you make a conscientious effort to atone for that and to compensate for that, to rectify that, at some time or another, you may step on the toe of somebody who was hurt in that process. But I find it difficult to feel sorry for people who, if they can't get in Harvard, can get in Yale. There's no real truth to the fact that anybody is denied an education. It may be in some specific instance. You may not at this point in history get in a particular school, but you have so many other opportunities that minorities don't have, that even if that happens, you can make it through and go right on about your business.
How do you see the United States? Are we going backwards here in some respect, or do you have hope that enough people will rally to protect things like affirmative action and struggle for equality that we can overcome whatever is happening in this country at the moment?
Oh, yes. I believe in the final triumph of righteousness. I believe that justice will prevail. Sometimes it takes a long time. The revolution that we experienced as a result of the movement precipitated a counter-revolution. And the counter-revolution now is seeking to redefine America in terms of the old Dixiecrat framing of public policy. So we've got to organize and coalesce and become more active in the name of Martin Luther King. This is a good time to renew that commitment to let justice roll down like waters and usher in a new phase of justice and equity in this country.
That was Reverend Joseph Lowry, co-founder and president emeritus of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Reverend Lowry currently works with the Black Leadership Forum, which can be contacted at area code 202-780-5599 or visit the group's website at www.blackleadershipforum.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.